There we go. That's a little better. 12:02. Good afternoon. It is Eric Scott, and it's Friday, and that means, of course, my guest is State Senator Jeb Bradley. But before we talk to him, I want to just commemorate an anniversary. It was 76 years ago today. Germany formally surrendered to the Allied powers. All military operations had wound down by tomorrow. Just thought I'd bring that up, especially with Jack Heath and talking about his veterans and all of that. So, Senator, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. You plan on getting some hiking in this weekend?
I don't know. You know, it's like it's May, and there's just a lot of work in the garden. And I think I enjoy gardening almost as much as I do hiking. So we'll see what happens.
It's always nice to, you know, so we have some blackberry bushes in our yard, and I do enjoy taking care of them. It's strangely relaxing. I don't know what it is about it.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, it's good exercise. It's great to watch everything, especially this time of year. Changes so much day to day, and we've gotten rain quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. It had been pretty dry. Boy, everything's just, you know, popping out and, you know, growing quickly with the additional rain. So, I don't know. It's great fun.
Yeah, it is. And maybe you can answer a question for me. As I think I've mentioned before, I've been watching Northwood's Law, which is... for those of you who don't know, a show about the fish and game officers here in New Hampshire. It's a fascinating show if you're into that kind of thing. A couple of days ago, they had one where they had to go up, I forget the name of the hill, and take somebody out who had a broken ankle. And they said the best thing to do would be to get them to the AMC hut. Now, to me, AMC is a cable channel. So, is this, I assume this is the Appalachian Mountain Club?
Yeah, no, that's the Appalachian Mountain Club. So there are 8 huts. I think all of them are either right on the Appalachian Trail or, you know, very close to it. And the furthest west is Lonesome Lake, which is near Cannon Mountain. And that's a beautiful hut right on, you know, a high-altitude lake. That's actually a pretty good-sized lake. In the winter, you can walk across the lake. I always enjoy, you know, going. It's, you're climbing the Kinsmans, doing that climb. And I love being able to walk across the ice, although it can be very, very windy up there sometimes. But in any case. And then the next hut is the Greenleaf Hut. That's below Mount Lafayette, and then going further to the east, there's Galehead Hut. That's between Galehead and South Twin. That, I think, is my favorite hut. It's newly renovated. I just always love being up there. And keeping going further east, is the next hut is Zealand. Great hut. It's kind of tucked away in the woods next to a waterfall, pretty cool hut. And then you drop down to the Highland Center and go back up to the Mizpah Hut, which is sort of on the south side of Mount Pierce and Eisenhower. And then you go up over and into the Presidentials. And then probably the most iconic hut is Lakes of the Clouds. They're two tiny little lakes up there. It's at 5,000 feet of elevation, and you go up over the summit of Mount Washington afterwards and end up at the hut at, I'm forgetting the name, I'm spacing it out. It's between Adams and Madison. So that's a great hut, too. Little lake there called Star Lake. And then it's a pretty good walk to the last hut, which is at the Little Lakes underneath Carter Dome, Carter Lakes Hut. So, if you're doing a rescue, I guess this is a long answer to a question, that's generally speaking a good place to try to get temporary shelter, maybe to do an evac if you have to, have a helicopter fly in. Most of them would have some accessibility for a helicopter. And that's why, especially in, you know, inclement weather or cold conditions, trying to get shelter is important.
I can imagine. Now, these huts are maintained. Who pays for them? Are they open 24 hours a day? Or?
So, no, they're not. Three of them are open with caretakers all season, all winter, and through, you know, the rest of the year. So the Carter Hut, Lonesome Lake, and Zealand is open. And so during the winter, people can go, and you have to take all your own food, but you do get shelter, and there's a person there at the hut. All the huts have natural gas, so you can cook on the stoves. You can get water. So it's kind of handy for winter hiking to be able to get water at these huts. The rest are closed, and they open up at certain times. So, like, Galehead Hut might be open pretty soon. Lakes in the Clouds, hut at Lafayette is open. They'd be open in probably Memorial Day time frame. And they're not open, the ones high up, Madison Springs, those three huts probably only stay open until mid-September. A couple of the other huts stay open a little longer, like Galehead.
Oh, that would probably help. And the Mountain Club, they raise funds to keep these up.
So the way it works is, I mean, obviously the Appalachian Mountain Club depends on membership. They're a 501c3, a not-for-profit organization. You obviously have to pay to stay at the huts, but you're well fed, and the cost of, getting, like, for instance, the gas up there is expensive. The food is all lugged up by hut workers, and when you see them out on the trail lugging 40 and 50 pound packs full of food for the next few days for people, they're working really hard. But in any case, you pay, and that provides the compensation for keeping the huts open. The huts are, I believe, on a 30-year lease from the White Mountain National Forest. I think they're a great asset for the White Mountains, and I've stayed at Madison Springs, I've stayed at Lakes, I've stayed at Galehead, but I've obviously been in all of the other huts. The one that is the favorite for families with young kids is Lonesome Lake, because you actually can swim in that lake. It'd be pretty cold right now. The ice is probably just barely gone. But kids love it, and their individual sort of accommodations for a family. That's a great hut, and it's easy to get up there. It's, about a mile and a half and a fairly easy trail. So that's a really good one for families. Another good one for families is Zealand Hut. The views aren't quite as nice, but the little waterfall that's there, kids enjoy that too.
Great. All right, it's 12:11 here on WASR. We're talking with Senator Jeff Bradley. Let's talk a little bit about something we haven't talked about in a while. That's mass transit. I was talking with my wife about this the other day, and the tracks are there. How come there's been no train to, say, from Concord to Boston? I know there are tracks.
There have been proposals to, for instance, bring the MTBA to Nashua. That's probably the biggest proposal. But I think the thing that you have to think about really is the expense of, you know, bringing trains and train service into New Hampshire that way versus upgrades to our road network. So it would be pretty expensive to, you know, do that. There is train service, obviously, between Boston and, you know, and Portland. So that's sort of been, you know, the issue in terms of train service. There are a lot of buses. You know, you can take a bus from Concord to Boston. That works pretty well. People do that very frequently. There's a park and ride in Londonderry. I think it's on exit 4 where people can hop on. There's bus service between Dover, Portsmouth, and Boston with big parking lots. So I think that, you know, when you're talking about mass transit, buses are a much more economical way to go. Maybe not quite as, they don't have that old world appeal, I guess, that trains have. But in terms of practicality and using the existing infrastructure, they are certainly more cost effective, I think, and pretty widely used also, than a train would be.
So do you think that's why these projects never got off the ground, is because there's no financial incentive to do them?
Yeah, I think the finance, a lot of people would support it, but the finances just, you know, in my opinion, haven't really worked as well as they would need to work to, justify it.
Well, you look at Amtrak, and they freely admit the only place they make money is the Boston-New York Washington corridor. The rest of the country runs at a loss. So then,
and that's because they have the volume. I mean, when I was commuting back and forth to Washington, you know, when I was in Congress, I probably 3/4 of the time would fly to Baltimore because there were just many more flights.
Oh yeah,
and it was easier because I could fly from Manchester on Southwest to Baltimore.
Yep.
And then I'd take the train, and, you know, it made a lot of sense there because it just, the use justified it. In more rural areas of New Hampshire, it's just, I don't think the use would be there to justify, you know, the cost of it. And so that's always been the problem.
By the way, for those of you who have never flown to Baltimore, you can take the MARC train. I think it's $4 or $5, and it dumps you off right at Union Station in the middle of the district. It's a great way to go and to avoid the cost and the hassle of National Airport or the huge commute from Dulles, which
yeah,
is
I mean,
way
I think Dulles
there.
Is more an international airport. I did used to fly some, you know, between National or Reagan Airport and Manchester, but the reason I would go to BWI is that I think that at the time there were 15 flights a day versus 2 or 3, in and out of National. And so it just made, to me, it just made, you know, a lot more sense to do it that way.
Do you ever try the Amtrak?
Well, I would take at the BWI, you know, train stop, I would take whichever came first.
Right.
So if it was MARC, generally speaking, you know, that would be practical if it came first. But if it was Amtrak, I'd get right on Amtrak. So it would depend on, you know, how quickly you could get the shuttle from the airport a lot of times, because the trains, you know, ran fairly frequently, between Baltimore and Washington, whether it was the MARC or Amtrak. So it would just depend on when I got there.
No, I mean, have you taken the Amtrak from Boston to Washington?
Oh, I did that a couple of times. Had to stop in Connecticut, so it just was easier than flying to do that. So I did it a couple of times. But generally speaking, I was just coming home, so I would fly to Manchester.
Okay. Thank you very much for listening today. 569-5253 if you have a question for the senator. Lots of things going on. You had mentioned right before we went on the air that you've been talking to the governor about a bunch of bills, and we'll get to some of those a little bit later. Was it last week or the week before we touched briefly on redistricting? I've been thinking about that, and I don't understand how they're drawn the way they are. Ideally, since there were two districts, you'd want about the same population. And if you just drew a line, especially, you know, the South, of course, having more population than the North. So how do they kind of figure that out?
So you're supposed to have within a certain percentile each district of Congress representing as close to that percentile fluctuation as possible, so that everybody's vote counts the same. So, for instance, if you were in a congressional district that had 1 million people versus a congressional district that only had 500,000 people, the vote is weighted more to the district where you're one of 500,000 than one of 1 million. So, constitutionally, one person, one vote tries to, you know, get to as close as possible to the mean around the country. And so based on the census, obviously a congressional district does not cross state lines. So, you know, there is some variation, but that's what is attempted to do. And so historically states have, you know, drawn their districts based on the particulars of that state. It is a state decision. It's not a federal decision.
Right.
But that's how it works. And every 10 years, when a new census comes out, depending on what the population increase or changes from one state to another, you know, you'll see a state gain districts, you'll see a state lose districts. So, for instance, this year, it appears that California is going to lose a seat for the first time ever because they're losing population. And, you know, it does have to be done within a, you know, the mathematical formula as closely as possible. But, you know, just in what little I've looked at, you know, what's going on the national scene, I have been aware that California is likely to lose that, you know, that seat.
Interesting. Now, that pretty much goes the same way, you know, in the state districts.
So, for the New Hampshire House, every county, House districts cannot cross county lines.
Okay.
That's just the way it is. And the reason for that is House members in New Hampshire sit as the budget committee, if you will, for county government. So the House members, for instance, in Carroll County have to oversee the budget that is proposed by the county commissioners. So that's why House districts stay within county boundaries. Senate districts can cross county boundaries. So Senate District 3, which is the Senate district I represent right now, is all of Carroll County. Waterville Valley is in Grafton County and is included in Senate District 3, as are Milton and Middleton, which are two towns in Stratford County. So how this is going to potentially change as we get the census data in, I think remains to be seen. There's been an awful lot of talk about you know, how the districts are going to get drawn. And it just, in having been through this process before, I tend to think, and I could be wrong, that they'll actually, at least in the state Senate districts, the change will not be that significant because I just don't see the math having changed that much over the last 10 years. But again, we'll see. Depends on what the census tells us.
Who is ultimately responsible for deciding what goes with what district?
So the House will propose a bill for House districts. The Senate will propose a bill for Senate districts, and we have to vote on it.
Okay. So the bill would say, okay, this district is going to have this, this, and this, and this district is going to have this. Is that how that works? Okay.
Yep. That's how it'll work.
Okay. And could there be multiple proposals for districts?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, look, redistricting is a partisan exercise. And even with, you know, the prospect of an independent redistricting commission, which I had supported in the past, as we've gotten, you know, closer to having to do redistricting, and the governor's vetoed it in the past, the Senate rejected it this time around. And quite frankly, I just think at this point, given the fact that we'll have to have the districts drawn by June of next year, not only drawn, but, you know, legislation passed, signed into law, and potentially subject to a challenge, that the process of an independent redistricting commission just has lost the amount of time that would be necessary for it. So having said that, I tend to think that the districts are not going to change that much just because of the math involved. They could change some, but, you know, we'll have to see when we get the census.
When do you expect that that stuff to come in?
Hopefully sometime this summer.
Okay, so relatively soon then.
Yeah, I mean, we're hopeful. Let's put it that way.
Now, I don't know if I apologize if I asked you last week. Are you guys meeting in person again?
Next Thursday is the first Senate session in person. The House has been meeting in person at the Bedford Sports Complex, and they are able to socially distance. And quite frankly, for the House to have met remotely with 400 people the way the Senate has would have been, it just would have been a practical impossibility.
Yeah.
I think that Mr. Packard has done a really good job of trying to facilitate meeting in this sports complex in Bedford and make it as safe as possible and as accessible as possible for the members. He has 400, you know, members that it's just so much more difficult than, you know, 24 senators just in terms of sheer volume. The speaker's been very gracious and will again allow the Senate to meet in the House chamber, and we're next Thursday we'll have a live session. It will look kind of strange if you're watching, you know, on the live feed that will be provided, because, you know, we'll 24 of us will be seated in 400 seats, but it will be socially distanced, and we've all agreed that, you know, when we're seated at our seats, we'll not need masks, but when we're moving around, all the senators will put masks on and try to protect each other and staff in that, you know, in that fashion. So it'll be good to get back in person. I've been a little bit more in the state house over the last few weeks, meeting with the governor, you know, talking about, you know, the budget or some other issues, and, you know, all the stimulus money that, you know, is on its way to New Hampshire and how to deal with that. But, you know, it'll be good to see my colleagues. It's been quite a while, actually.
I'm sure it has. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would assume most of you have already been vaccinated?
I have been, and I think most of the senators have been. Certainly, everybody has had access to vaccines. So at this point, if you're not vaccinated, you've made that choice, which I'm good with that too. I think that's the way it should be, especially, you know, with a vaccine that's still under emergency authorization. But I believe that most senators are. Obviously, it's a health decision. So unless, you know, another senator has told me that they aren't, I don't really know. Or that they are, I don't really know. But the one thing I do know is that everybody's had the opportunity to be vaccinated, and I can speak for myself, I have been vaccinated.
And so have I, and I'll tell you, I'm looking forward to the freedom that comes with that. I think that a lot of us are just really, really tired of this whole
thing. People are ready to, and I think you're seeing it happening, Eric, as people are getting back to, you know, a more typical lifestyle.
I'm seeing Tesla.
It's happening. But
it is.
You know, we still have to continue to be safe and act accordingly. No question about that. I think that, you know, we're moving toward more of a personal responsibility way of dealing with a pandemic than government mandates. And I think that's appropriate at this point. You know, whether you wear a mask, and I think most businesses are still requiring masks. You know, when you're inside, I'm going to continue to, whenever I'm inside, just out of respect, wear a mask. But, you know, I've been able to go out to eat a couple of times, and certainly, you know, that's been very enjoyable.
Okay. Speaking of going out to eat, how, I believe we talked a couple of weeks ago about a temporary change in the rooms and meals tax. Did that pass, or is that held up?
That's in the budget. So, you know, the Senate is now really right in the middle of writing the budget. Agency presentations, I think, ended earlier this week. So, you know, starting next week, the seven members of the Finance Committee are going to, you know, work on what the governor submitted, what the House has passed, what individual senators, you know, want to see reflected as priorities. So, you know, I think by probably 2 weeks from today, we'll have a pretty good idea of where we're going. I think the vote on the Senate budget in the Finance Committee will happen somewhere in the last week of May, and we will be voting on it 4 weeks from yesterday.
Now, when you say agency presentations, is that like, for instance, Department of Health and Human Services?
Different departments, yes.
And they do the whole dog and pony show, this is how much money we need?
Yep.
That's okay.
What happened.
It sounds interesting, actually. However, I guess after a while, it kind of, I mean, with all of the different departments, eventually you're just like, all right, enough of this.
Well, I think that for, you know, I've never sat on a finance committee, and I have worked with Senator Morse and, you know, finance committee members on the policy bill that always accompanies the budget. You get a pretty good idea of, you know, how state government runs, you know, when you participate in, you know, those discussions, and, you know, it is pretty interesting. It's very time consuming. You obviously, you know, the priorities, I think, are that you always want to try to make sure we're funding the needs of, you know, folks in the state of New Hampshire while, you know, at the same time, protecting taxpayers, making sure the tax burden is acceptable. And I think the budget is always a blueprint for how, you know, you're going to provide for a growing economy, hopefully. And so, you know, the tax policy that gets set in the budget, the spending priorities, you know, this year is obviously a very different year, and we've discussed that a lot of times on your show, Eric, you know, both in terms of the revenue that was lost a year ago during the throes of the pandemic, but now it's all starting to come back. The April revenue numbers were released earlier this week. April's a very big month for revenue. It's a very important month because, you know, that's when so many you know, taxes are due, and our revenue came in, I think it was $84.5 million ahead of plan, and the plan was adopted in 2019. So the plan did not take into account, you know, the pandemic. And the first year of the budget that ended on July 1st of 2020, we were down about $130 million. This year, we're up well over that. And so we are, again, dealing with surpluses, which is a, you know, great place to be in. I think that we're going to be able to put more money into the rainy day fund. We should be able to fund some priorities like mental health, hopefully dedicate more dollars to cities and towns through an increase in the formula, the Rooms and Meals revenue sharing. I hope that we're able to continue to help communities that don't have as robust a property tax base with their education funding costs. These are all priority things that I'd like to see funded in the budget. So, you know, we just we'll see how it goes. There are a lot of different people have a lot of different priorities, and try to, you know, make them all match and work together is always rather, you know, it's like a puzzle.
So assuming that the budget comes in with a surplus, which we can all hope, the money isn't automatically refunded to taxpayers. You find other things to do with it. You said the rainy day fund, which,
well,
of course, is a great idea.
But it also sets the stage, I'm sorry to interrupt,
that's okay,
for the tax policies in the budget. So the lower rooms and meals tax, the governor proposed to take it from 9% to 8.5%. You probably, you know, you would ask the question, well, why is that, you know, a good idea? Because, you know, on a $100 meal, if you go out to your favorite restaurant, it's a difference of 50 cents, you know, $9 versus $8.50. Why is that a big deal? Does it encourage people to eat out more? And the answer probably is no. However, when New Hampshire is trying to promote itself as a destination for functions like weddings or conferences or any big gatherings that, you know, are subject to the rooms and meals tax, the differential, especially on a wedding of even 0.5%, can make a difference. And so we do have one of the higher rooms and meals taxes in the area, you know, in the states around us. And if we're more competitive, that's an inducement to do things in New Hampshire. So we'll see, you know, if we can fit everything together. That's a, you know, a tax decrease. We're proposing to take down, again, further reduce the business enterprise tax, which is a tax that business owners pay on the payroll of individual employees. I mean, honestly, it is an income tax, but it's paid by the business owner. It's a very small percentage. I think it's 0.6% today. We're hoping to drop it to 0.5%. That is one of the bigger taxes. And if we can make New Hampshire more competitive by reducing, you know, the business enterprise tax and the business profits tax, which is a tax on a corporation's profits, I think, you know, it makes our state more competitive. And, you know, people always say, well, you're going to lose revenue. You're going to lose revenue. We've been hearing that argument for 5 years, and my response is we've made New Hampshire more competitive. We've made it more attractive for businesses to stay here or to relocate here or to expand here. And there are a lot of, you know, inducements for being in New Hampshire, but we do have high health care costs. We do have high electricity costs. And so we're competing with, you know, states like Florida and Texas. And so anything that we can do to lower some of our other costs, taxes being one of them, in combination with the fact that we don't have an income tax or a sales tax, makes New Hampshire attractive. And that's why, you know, coming out of the pandemic, our unemployment rate is 3% now. We're doing great. And, in fact, businesses need people to go, you know, back to work. And that's becoming more and more of a priority every day. So that all those tax changes are going to be in this budget. And that's what I mean about you absolutely have to meet the needs of the people of the state, whether it's mental health or substance abuse or any of the other things that are important. But you also have to, through the tax policy that underwrites the budget, try to make New Hampshire as competitive as possible for people who want to stay here, to move here, locate a business here, all of those things.
All right. 12:38 on WASR. We're talking with Senator Jeb Bradley and 569-5253. If you have a question or a comment, 569-LAKE is that number. I'm curious about something, and I know I've asked it before, but maybe you can kind of help me with this. I was in a discussion with a friend of mine, and we were discussing the difference, believe it or not, between SSI and SSDI. And I was hoping maybe you could kind of straighten this out here. There's a state portion of this, I think, somewhere. And how does any of that affect the bill that you've been shepherding, the Medicaid dental bill?
So SSI, I'm assuming you mean Social Security income. And
the one for low-income people.
So, okay, I think Social Security is a federal, obviously, that's federal. And then there's I think SSDI is disability.
Right.
But I think what you're talking about, Eric, is people's income eligibility for Medicaid. Okay?
Okay.
So Medicaid is an income eligibility-driven program that provides people that are below a certain level of income with health care. And so through the efforts that we've had over the past, 10 years, we have increased the number of people that have access to Medicaid as their health insurance. And it is for people of much more modest means. And it's actually good for, the business community or anybody with private insurance, because what's happened, before we had a more expansive, view of Medicaid, people would just end up at the emergency room far sicker than, they should have been had they had access to Medicaid. And that's an unreimbursed cost because they don't have insurance. And so what happens? Well, it has to get paid for somehow. And so when hospitals negotiate the rates that insurers pay them for coverage of people with private insurance, those uncompensated costs go against that, and a hospital recovers it from higher insurance costs out of the private market. And that private market, that's just a negotiated aspect of healthcare. And if we didn't do that, hospitals would fold. So by covering more people on Medicaid, we reduce that uncompensated care level and help keep a lid on rising health insurance costs in the private market. So the question today is, are we going to create a dental benefit for adults that are Medicaid eligible? And I hope the answer is yes. I mean, we need to do it in a very cost-effective way. It would appear that it's somewhere in the $6 million range to do that. Better dental health produces better overall physical health because there's just a lot of diseases connected to poor dental health. When you have better overall health, the healthcare costs on that end of the spectrum should be reduced over time that, in my view, will mitigate against the increased cost for the dental benefit, to say nothing of the fact that better overall health, whether it's dental or other physical or mental health, just enables more people to work better, be better, you know, participants in their community, all of those kind of things. So I think that you obviously want these programs to run as cost effectively as possible. I think, you know, the proposal that's in the Senate right now does that. And, you know, I hope that we're able to, you know, pass it and implement it. It takes a while to implement, but, you know, implement it probably by the end of, you know, 2022 time frame.
Okay, now, I don't know if you can speak to this or not, but all over television you've seen, or you may have seen, Joe Namath talking about the Medicare helpline.
And yeah, so what,
you know, one of the things
what Broadway Joe is talking about,
yeah,
and he was a Jet, so you know you got to take that into account because I'm a Patriots fan. He is talking about the Medicare health benefit, and Medicare is the health insurance program in our country for anybody that's 65.
Right.
That's a federal program. The state has nothing to do with it.
Okay.
So when you're seeing Joe on TV, that is for Medicare, is for seniors over 65 that, according to the ads, may well be eligible for more benefits, and they should dial the number that Joe Namath is telling you to dial.
Yeah, and I'm
not. That's all I can tell you.
Right, and I'm not endorsing it. I'm just mentioning it. However, I noticed that one of the things he talks about, what do they name it? The give back benefit, where money is added back into your Social Security check. Now, I did a little Googling, and from what I was able to find, that's a state program, qualified Medicare beneficiary.
No, I
could be wrong.
I don't know what it is. So I honestly, I wish I could give you more feedback on that, but I can't.
No, that's okay. It happens. One of the things that you know, I've heard about before, and I was listening to Jack Heath earlier this morning, and it seems
Jack's going to be upset with me. I apologize because I was overwhelmed with a committee that I thought was going to be done by my normal time slot of 11:30, and it wasn't. So I had to miss my normal weekly call-in with Jack. So if you talk to Jack, Eric, you can explain to him what happened, please.
I will be glad to. I will be shooting him an email on another matter, so I'll convey your apologies. But the other thing I wanted to talk about is, you know, while we're on this thing, I hear a lot of we want to have less government. We want government out of our fill in the name of the blank. We want it out of our bedrooms. We want it out of our workplaces. We want it out of everybody. But yet, and this is the part I don't understand, we don't have a helmet law. We don't have a seatbelt law, which is fine. I have no problem with those. But yet we have some of the strictest motor vehicle inspections in the country. Aren't people responsible enough to maintain their own vehicles?
Well, you know, I think this is the tug and pull, if you will, you know, between individual liberties and the role of government in society. And there's always, you know, that natural friction, if you will, you know, between that. And, you know, I try to come down on the side of individual liberties, but at the same time, you know, I think especially in this area of the country, having your car inspected every year because of the impact of, you know, weather, salt, things like that is not a bad idea, to catch safety problems before, you know, they manifest themselves on the road. Other states have, you know, a longer time frame, and I get that, but you know, that historically has been what we've done in New Hampshire, and I think, you know, it's probably served us pretty well.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
Because I know the New Hampshire Automobile Dealers Association has a lot of clout, and I'm sure that they'd be very upset if somebody brought up a bill to wipe out state inspections.
Well, that has come up, and it's been, you know, it's been defeated because I think that those are the safety arguments that, you know, get made with, at least in my view, you know, they're appropriate arguments.
You know,
Not everybody agrees with that, but...
Right, and I can't say that I do, because if my car breaks down, that's my problem. But that's, you know,
I think
that,
that
is what it is.
The difference between your car breaking down, though, and your brakes giving out when you need your brakes to avoid an accident. So I think that's the natural tension, you know, between, you know, the points of view. So,
yeah, I don't know. I keep on top of, regardless of whether I have to inspect my car or not, I do make sure that it's taken care of, because that way you don't break down in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, no, I understand both sides, obviously.
Right, and you know, we could discuss it all day, but I won't. But in our remaining time, we had talked up at the top of the right before we went on the air at the top of the hour about House Bill 341 and its effect on more affordable housing. It's a fascinating bill. As I was kind of looking over it in. What do they call that? Bill track or whatever it was. This is the one, correct me if I'm wrong, where if you have a single family home or a duplex, you can rehabilitate it into up to 4 units.
I have it up now. That's what it appears to allow. It's a House bill. Let's see what happened to it. I think it's been laid on the table in the House. We have not seen it. It's not been introduced in the Senate. So I assume that's what's happened to it. I'm looking at the docket. It doesn't even appear to have had a roll call. So I know that a lot of bills in the House, they reached the end of, they had a 3-day marathon session and didn't get to a number of bills, and I suspect that's what happened, although it doesn't indicate it was tabled, so I'm having a hard time figuring this out. But it has not been introduced in the Senate.
Okay, so it's quite a ways from going anywhere. But the advantage of that bill is it would be good for landlords who could create more rental housing, and that's probably not a bad thing.
Yeah, I think there's always this, you know, talk about natural tension between, you know, statewide issues and local issues. And so zoning is historically in New Hampshire always been a local issue, and quite frankly, local officials will, you know, always tell me keep those decisions locally, because local officials believe, and I think with justification, that they better know the issues in their community than, you know, the state having a one size fits all approach
right.
to local land use.
Makes sense.
Okay? Having said that, affordable housing in New Hampshire is a huge concern. And I think one of the reasons why a lot of people, younger people that, you know, may go to school here, would probably like to live here, but have a hard time finding housing here, whether it's rental housing or affordably priced housing to buy. And so there's that natural tension, and a proposal like this, a statewide proposal like this, would be a one-size-fits-all, and I'm sure that there's been a lot of backlash to you know, overriding local zoning. And I think there'd be a lot of backlash if you allowed, you know, single-family homes to be converted per state regulations into what this bill would allow is, I think, a four single units, one duplex, or two accessory dwelling units. That's a big change for a lot of towns to, you know, embrace if the state were mandating it. I suspect that's why it hasn't gone too far. But let me just talk about affordable housing
Sure. For
a minute, because, you know, I've sponsored legislation over the last few years that has put, you know, new resources into what we call the Affordable Housing Fund, Eric. And that is, much of it is done on a revolving loan basis, some grants coming out of the fund, but it provides developers of affordable housing with lower access to capital. And so it has jump-started the process of building workforce housing. So Harriman Hill, for instance, in Wolfboro, or a couple of projects in Conway have utilized the Affordable Housing Fund. I hope with, you know, some of the dollars that are going to come our way from the federal stimulus that we're able to, you know, put a fairly significant amount of money into the Affordable Housing Fund this year to jumpstart or continue to, you know, enhance our ability to provide for affordable workforce housing. I mean, it's critical need in the state of New Hampshire. I think it quite frankly is an impediment to being able to, you know, for businesses to be able to grow, to get healthcare workers. I mean, we have shortages across the spectrum of healthcare workers in the state. And again, affordable housing is something that we clearly have to do. So, you know, that is one of the priorities that I've had, you know, for a number of years. It's really a need in our state and something that's very important.
Okay. It is 12:55 here on WASR. Thank you very much for listening today. As we talk about this, you mentioned that there's a shortage of healthcare workers. Is our unemployment rate too low?
Well, it's never too low, because the more people that are working, that's a good thing. And the more people are able to find jobs, that's a great thing.
Right. But the problem is, as you know, there are jobs going begging.
Yeah. And so with the unemployment rate being so low and more employers offering more in terms of hourly wages or compensation, you know, to get people, people, I think, will be coming back into the workforce. And that's, you know, when the incentives are right, people will do that. And certainly, as we get schools open, that takes the pressure off parents that, you know, sometimes have had to give up jobs because they, you know, have kids at home. Or people that are, you know, senior citizens that are maybe looking to supplement their, you know, Social Security income. If the incentives are right, they go back to work with a lot of experience, quite frankly, in the workforce. So I think that, you know, with a 3% unemployment rate, it's great that so many people are able to find jobs or have jobs. But, you know, we need to continue to, you know, have the incentives, which we clearly have today, with businesses offering more for people to do, you know, the kind of work that we need done, people will respond. I think, you know, look at the construction industry right now. It is very hard to get people, you know, to do, you know, construction work because they're out straight. And so, you know, our community colleges focusing on, you know, training electricians or training plumbers or, you know, things like that. I mean, vitally important. I think that we absolutely need to, you know, do everything that we can to support the community colleges, because they educate those kind of jobs that are so important today.
Oh, I agree. And skilled trade jobs are they pay well. They tend to be recession resistant. Things like nursing and auto repair and electrical plumbing and heating and things like that. The only problem I see is, and maybe this is, I don't know if something something might be worth it or not, but when my daughter got out of college as an LPN, she was already $30,000 in debt. She's looking at getting her RN with another huge amount of debt. I mean, by this point, she could have bought a Mercedes. You know, but that's an awful lot of money. And I'm wondering if some people are just hesitant about going into those things just because of the huge cost of admission.
They're clearly, especially university education, the traditional liberal arts, colleges are, you know, at risk of pricing themselves out of the market for people that just simply can't afford the student loans. And the fact that the federal government has taken over student loans hasn't alleviated the problem. And, you know, that clearly is a problem. To me, the focus needs to be where we have, you know, taxpayer-funded dollars to try to, you know, do what we need to do for the community college system, because they're doing, in my opinion, a much, much better job of educating, you know, people for the jobs that need to be filled, and they're doing it very cost-effectively. And, I think that's critically important for our state.
All right. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. So, Senator Jeb Bradley, again, thank you very much for volunteering your time and keeping us up to date on what's going on in Concord and explaining some of those things so some, you know, people like me can understand them.
Always a pleasure. Take care, and look forward to talking to you next week.
Thank you, Senator. You take care.
Okay. Take
care. Bye now. 1 o'clock. News is next on WASR.